Okay, King Me. It may be good for the king, but behaving like a king with limitless powers just may be hazardous to the U.S. Constitution. The first order of business for the Obama administration may be Article 2, after 8 years of Bush-Cheney checking the king thing. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 6th. And John, I got to tell you, I wouldn't mind being queen for a day or a week or even a month.
I've noticed. Yes. So good morning, Dora.
But it is problematic when you're talking about kings in the U.S. Constitution. We'll have a report on that. We'll also have a global view this morning, both of our elections and a disturbing death in a neighboring country. Stories are coming up. But first, these headlines.
Hold your horses. 2012, those are Alaska crowds cheering Governor Sarah Palin's homecoming, but they could just as well be reminding us that as soon as we put one endless campaign behind us, another marathon lurks. But of course, politics goes on. Final control of the Senate isn't determined yet. Four races have not been called, and the results are crucial because four is also the magic number Democrats need to win for a filibuster proof majority. What is wrong with me? Assuming, of course, that independent Joe Lieberman continues voting with Democrats. More on that later in the show. In Minnesota, the Senate race is drum tight enough to trigger an automatic recount. Republican incumbent Norm Coleman leads Democrat Al Franken by a few hundred votes.
Many of you know I just got back from Georgia, where a tight race, at least for Senate, is in heading for a runoff at this point. Republican Saxby Chambliss is the incumbent. He got a 3-point lead over Democratic Jim Martin, but he doesn't have the required majority to win. Votes are still being counted, but if the current figures hold, the candidates will meet in December for a rematch. No doubt something the Democrats would like. Alaska and Oregon are the other undecided races. Plenty of votes still left to count in both of those states. And dead for this year, that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's assessment of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. She's in the Mideast today, and just a few minutes ago, she said it doesn't appear a deal can be cut this year. Like President Bush, Israel's prime minister is a lame duck.
Secretary of State is just one job Barack Obama now has to fill. It's widely reported that his first job offer is to Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff. He's expected to name a Treasury secretary quickly, the president-elect is, and he signaled he may ask current Defense Secretary Robert Gates to stick around. Results are finally in a hard-fought and closely watched California ballot measure. Voters there passed a measure to ban gay marriage. Gay rights groups immediately challenged the measure in court. Challenging day for world markets so far. European markets are down at the moment. Asian markets closed way down. A lousy Wednesday on Wall Street yesterday. The Dow and the S&P lost more than 5%, and they are poised for a negative open this morning. But it's time for America to brief the new president, wouldn't you say?
The one book that I recommend for Barack Obama, which I'm sure he probably has read, but it's called The Art of War, and it's a classic Chinese book by Sun Tzu.
We want to know, what page would you add to Barack Obama's briefing book as he prepares to take office? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or 877-8-MY-TAKE, or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I want to begin by getting you up to date on a cascade of interest rate cuts across Europe and England this morning. The Bank of England cut its interest rate by 1.5% to 3%, and the European Central Bank followed suit with a 0.5% rate cut, all amidst the recessionary woes. Rahm Emanuel, the Illinois congressman, is mulling over a job offer to be chief of staff in the Obama transition. Mulling it over? The nerve of that guy. Well, there are 15 cabinet vacancies to fill and a lot more to project to the world as crisis crises loom everywhere. To take a look at what the Obama cabinet and this new administration may look like, we turn to David Mark, the senior editor for Politico. David, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
We've already got one name. I do want to talk names with you. And Rahm Emanuel is apparently going to be the chief of staff of this new administration and also responsible for managing this transition, such as it is. But how do you think this transition, given this moment in history, is going to be different from many others we've experienced in the last generation?
Oh, I think this is going to be one of the most challenging transitions probably since the Great Depression between the handover from Herbert Hoover to FDR more than 75 years ago. We've got this economic meltdown going on. We've got ongoing shooting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then just yesterday, the Russian President Medvedev says that if the U.S. goes ahead with a missile shield program, he's going to put short-range missiles near Poland capable of striking into Europe. So, boy, he didn't waste any time. That just shows what the challenges Obama is facing.
It's also the case that, you know, we've been talking about this long campaign. As the long campaign has gone along, there's also been a very long sort of vacuum of power in Washington. I'm wondering if the government is ready and is anxious for the levers of power to be grasped maybe even before Inauguration Day on January 20th in some way.
Well, I think Obama probably wants to be very careful about that because he doesn't want to look like he's taking ownership for any Bush policies. He wants a clean break from the Bush administration. That's what he ran on. He doesn't want to get lured into any kind of joint co-governing, anything of that nature. So I think he's going to keep a cool, respectful detachment from the Bush administration and not really to do too much publicly until he actually takes office on January 20th.
Well, what does the Rahm Emanuel appointment mean at this stage? And I guess he hasn't officially accepted yet, or there's some sort of ambiguity about that. But if he does accept, what does it mean?
Well, it would provide Obama with a Capitol Hill veteran, somebody who can get things done on Capitol Hill, who knows the personalities, who comes from that milieu, and is a deal maker. The drawback, of course, is that Rahm Emanuel is a fierce partisan. He's part of the Democratic leadership, and he's going to be distrusted by Republicans. Then again, the Obama administration doesn't really need Republicans very much because they have the votes to muscle through what they want.
And David, is this a sign of things to come? This was a campaign run by Barack Obama that was built this reputation of having no leaks. The fact that Rahm Emanuel's name is now floating out there, apparently leaked by a number of Democrats, I mean, what does that say?
I was very surprised by that because now if Emanuel doesn't accept, it makes Obama look like a chump. Even if he does accept now, it makes it look like he's the supplicant, like he's the one who's waiting for people to accept jobs from him, not the other way. It should be the other way around. I think they probably learned a valuable lesson from this, and they're going to keep this information even more tightly held. This actually leaked a couple days before Election Day, so they probably
It was almost immediately retracted. Well, let's listen to the just unbridled, overwhelming enthusiasm that Rahm Emanuel is expressing in reaction to this leak.
I got a lot to weigh. My commitment to my country, my commitment to public service and why I got into this, as well as my commitment to my family and what I want to do as a parent.
That's not a yes, David.
Right. That's actually a responsible answer. It's just not the kind of enthusiastic overture you want from an incoming administration. You would want to say, yeah, sign me up. I'll be there whenever you want. And I think the longer this goes on, the worse Obama kind of looks here. So I think they probably want to put this to bed today. They're probably saying to Emanuel, are you in or out? Are you going to do it or not? Let's get going here.
Well, you're right to focus the question on whether this is a reach across the aisle Capitol Hill move or a keep the Democrats in line, we don't need Republicans move. Let's move to Treasury Secretary. Oddly, in this environment, that's the sort of number one position right now. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, it's funny. Just a couple of years ago, I think most people couldn't even name the Treasury Secretary. A lot of the speculation now is centering around Timothy Geithner. He's president of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. He is a very well-known kind of left-leaning economist. There's a couple former Treasury Secretaries in the mix, Lauren Summers, Robert Rubin, maybe even John Corzine, the governor of New Jersey, former Goldman Sachs executive. Or it could be somebody we're not discussing at all right now.
What is the importance of getting that position named early? I mean, does the Treasury Secretary have the ability, even unconfirmed, to quiet Wall Street and to be a part of this sort of economic rescue package that's going on?
Right. It sends a signal to the markets. There's also an economic summit, kind of the G20 summit coming up with mostly European and Latin American countries that the Bush administration is going to participate in. I would imagine the new Treasury Secretary designate would also take part in that. It's really to send a signal publicly and then to have that ready, that person ready to be confirmed and take office on January 20th, 2009.
As possibly the first nomination, David, what do you think the Barack Obama folks need to weigh in deciding?
Well, they need to figure out what their most important campaign promise was. Was it the economy, which was kind of a late-breaking issue and probably won the election for Barack Obama over the last 2 months or so? Or was it the issue he focused on for more than a year earlier in his campaign, which was withdrawing troops from Iraq, reoriented the war on terror against Afghanistan? If so, I would say Secretary of State is a very important post. One they mentioned is John Kerry, senator from Massachusetts, of course, former Democratic presidential nominee. I would expect that post to be named very quickly.
I would be surprised if he names Kerry. Again, I just think change is a really important kind of buzzword here for this campaign, and I think new names and new personalities may be a better projection of that change message, but that's just my opinion. Question for you, though. Do you think Barack Obama is actually going to give Colin Powell a shot at doing it again and making his legacy all right?
I'm not sure Colin Powell would want that at this point. I think he realized
it's all over the rumor mill, though.
Yeah, what it takes to be in the public eye and the slings and arrows of it. To be Secretary of State, that would be really something to be.
Or defense, or even defense.
Yeah, possible. If he could persuade Powell to do it, I'm not sure Powell needs it at this point. The thing that Powell realizes is, though, even if it's a very powerful position, you're still in a subordinate position. And even though he wasn't treated very well by the Bush administration, Obama probably has his own center of power, and I think he would want some kind of guarantees of autonomy, and I'm not sure that could be provided.
David, do you think perhaps on their agenda is maybe even shaking up the cabinet, perhaps adding a seat? I was in Atlanta yesterday, and I was talking to Ambassador Andrew Young, the former ambassador to the UN in the Carter administration, and he was saying how back then his job as UN ambassador was a cabinet position. Given the extraordinary challenges the U.S. faces on the foreign policy front, is that possibly in the mix?
That is certainly one possibility. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that. I believe Bill Clinton had a similar arrangement during his presidency. We've heard some interesting names for UN ambassador, including Caroline Kennedy. I don't know how serious that is, but I would imagine repairing relations with allies overseas, that's going to be a big push in this administration very early on.
Well, David Mark, broadly and strategically then, lay it out. What is the mix of you did me a favor, so I'm going to reward you kind of cabinet appointments versus the sort of best and brightest, maybe even team of rivals style appointments, which represent people with solid expertise, maybe a little bit of autonomy, maybe with their own agendas, but people who are absolutely top-notch operators in their field?
Well, that's what the appointment of Rahm Emanuel's chief of staff would certainly indicate. He's a sharp-edged partisan, but he is no shrinking violet. He's not going to be a yes man to Barack Obama. He's going to provide some differing points of view, and I think that's what Obama is looking for. Obama is a law professor by trade who likes the Socratic method. He likes to think through ideas. So I think he really would be looking for a diverse group of ideas. Not just yes men. One other thing, though, is he promised to be a leader, to reach across the aisle. He didn't promise to be a centrist, though, and his policy positions are pretty tilted to the left, agree or disagree. And I would look for appointments to go in that direction. I don't know that they're going to be particularly centrist.
Well, that's an interesting point. David Mark, the senior editor of Politico, talking about the transition and who we might see in the transition team. Thank you, David.
So much for a honeymoon period. He's certainly going to be under a lot of pressure to put some names out there.
Well, and with the markets tanking, too, we want you to be a part of the briefing book at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This morning, the Senate race in Georgia is still unclear, with questions about how and why early votes have not been tabulated. To talk about that and other voting issues across the country, we're joined by Susanna Capoluto, who's been following the story for Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Paul Gronke, director of the Early Voting Information Center and professor of political science at Reed College. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, Adora.
We're going to start in Georgia. What is happening with the count between Republican Senator, the incumbent, Saxby Chambliss, and his challenger, Democrat Jim Martin?
Well, Adora, it looks right now Saxby Chambliss still has 49.9% of the vote, and his challenger is, you know, a little under that. And then we have that Libertarian in the race who has a little bit over 3%. And we have about 30,000 absentee ballots yet to be counted in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta. So the question is, Fulton County, these absentee votes, I think 90% of those would need to go to Saxby Chambliss in order for him to get that 0.1%, which, this being Atlanta, might be unlikely. So he is already in runoff mode. But we will know certainly by this afternoon, they say, all these votes will be counted.
And there's no way Martin can get it, no matter how many go, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
if you add 30, he's at 46%.
Right.
In Georgia, you have to have that 50.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, no, I got you.
So it's a question of where they what puts him over the top to that 50% plus one vote. But why has it taken so long for them to count these votes in Fulton County? And is it just absentee votes, or are we also talking about early ballots?
Well, the thing is, both of them set them back a little bit. This was the first time we did this. And the goal was to get a quarter of all the electorate voting before Election Day. It turns out half of Georgia's electorate actually voted, because our overall turnout was lower than expected. We thought 80% would come out, but it was actually 74% of total voters came, and that's even less than 4 years ago. But what happened, so you had half of the votes that needed to be counted were absentee or early votes. So that took a long, long time. And basically, Fulton County workers got tired and they sent some of them home to get some sleep and come back and keep counting today. So that's what we have been waiting so long. It is the first time Georgia has done early voting. And I think officials, including state officials, are looking at this very closely to see, you know, what they can do to 'cause people were coming out in droves voting early. I mean, it was really pushed hard, and it's almost like they pushed it a little bit too hard.
We're going to turn to Paul then, Paul Gronke.
Well, they're counting
Georgia,
votes in Oregon, too. They're counting votes in his state, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, Paul Gronke, this push for early voting triggered some problems, at least in Georgia and Oregon, but overall, how did it work?
Well, you know, the overall, it seems to have worked pretty well. It reduced the pressures on Election Day in a lot of jurisdictions. So the lines in Georgia, my understanding, were not as long. Florida still had some problems. North Carolina reports were relatively low lines on Election Day. New Mexico and some other states, Colorado, that had heavy early voting. And they encountered fewer problems this year in 2008, even with the high turnout, than they did in 2004 with a somewhat lower turnout.
You had 85% turnout there in Oregon, and it's an all-mail-in system there. Does that create problems when you have a really close vote like the Gordon Smith, the Senate race?
Well, that's right, John. I actually just checked the Oregon Secretary of State. They're currently at about 84%. It isn't necessarily related to the close election. Look, the thing with a close election is whenever you look close, you're going to see more flaws. We're certainly going to find some flaws in Minnesota because that election is so close.
it's an automatic recount in Minnesota. So any time things are close, these kinds of flaws become more apparent. What happens in Oregon this year in particular is a lot of ballots came in late. It's not clear why. About a third of the ballots came in the last 2 days. Typically, it's 10 to 15%. I don't know why that happened this year, whether we had a lot of initiatives, whether it was our hard-fought Senate race. The presidential contest was never really close here. But when you have that many ballots coming in late, it simply takes an amount of time to push all that paper through the machines.
And, Paul, let's talk about the electronic voting machines. That was something that was big in the last couple of years, but it seems to be that many forewent those electronic machines and just relied on the paper ballots.
That's right. A good example down near Georgia is Florida, which went away from what we call the DRE, the direct recording electronic machines, and went to paper, and actually that transition caused them some problems. There still are a fair amount of electronic machines out there. There are some security concerns. It does seem right now that the national move is to move back to paper, but that's going to move us back likely to heavier use of absentee balloting as well. And when a lot of absentee ballots come in late in Georgia, I think the problems in Georgia, by the way, are not with the early in-person votes, but it is with the absentees.
Right.
For an unexpectedly high number of absentees, and those ballots are just slow to process.
And Susanna, it certainly feeds. I just came back from Atlanta, and the fact that there are votes that have not been counted, it feeds this conspiracy notion that somehow in Atlanta, where you have a great majority of African-American voters, that somehow their votes are not counted. It feeds that idea. I heard a lot of people talking about that.
Oh, absolutely. There is this fear. You know, especially our Secretary of State is a Republican, and people just feed off of that, thinking that there might be something fishy going on. But really, it is procedural. I mean, this is what it boils down to. Fulton County has not counted all the ballots. They just weren't prepared to count all the ballots. They didn't have enough workers. You know, they didn't prepare. This was the first time they're doing this. And I want to say something about machines. Georgia is the was the first state in the nation after the 2000 election that made touch screens unanimous everywhere. So everybody votes on a touch screen. They have been used in 14 elections in Georgia, I think, now the 15th. And with the actual machines, there has never, ever been a challenge.
Oh, that's great.
Other than machines breaking down. But the thing is, because of a lot of people not trusting the fact that you just touch the machine, Diebold, the company that, of course, makes them, no longer makes the machines, which is not good for us. If they break down, hey, we can't get a replacement. But that's the thing. They're not investing into that touchscreen technology at all, even though it has proven to really seem to work in Georgia. So it's sort of interesting that that never is mentioned in any of the discussions.
Well, Susanna Capoluto, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Susanna is from Georgia Public Broadcasting, and a big thanks to you and also to Paul Gronke, director of the Early Voting Information Center and professor of political science at Reed College.
You know, this is a great time for you to be a part of the briefing for Barack Obama as he prepares his transition team. Barbara emails us and says that the new president should read Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines by Richard Muller. Physics for those who can't handle higher mathematics. I especially recommend the terrorist nukes chapter. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Time for headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Time just coming up to 27 minutes to the top of the hour. Barack Obama is getting down to business. He's asked Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel to be his chief of staff, and there are rumors in Washington that he'll include Republicans in the cabinet. A Treasury Secretary announcement is expected next. President Bush has promised a smooth transition of power to President-elect Barack Obama. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick says that the White House team overseeing the handover has already started work.
Our transition team went down to the transition space here at the Department of State. You know, they checked out the phones, computers, lights, and so forth. So whenever the transition team is ready to take up occupancy over here, the State Department will be ready.
And the handover team is 24 people strong. It will help with security clearances, legal and human resources, paperwork, and plenty more paperwork. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders today, and she acknowledged that the goal of reaching a peace agreement for the region by the end of the year is probably out of reach. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will meet today with executives from Ford, General Motors and Chrysler. They will discuss the financial crisis and possible access to government funding. Last week, Treasury officials denied GM a $10 billion loan. And a new congressional report says that $6 billion in aid did little to cut drug production in Colombia. They found that coca farming's actually increased by 15% since 2000, but the plan's increased security did help to reduce murders and kidnappings. Let's look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi. And now we go to London.
I'm sure the whole House will also wish to join me in sending our sincere congratulations to Senator Barack Obama on winning the presidency of the United States and writing a new chapter in history in doing so. The bonds that unite the United States and the UK are vital to our prosperity and security, and I know from talking to Senator Obama that he will be a true friend of Britain.
That's Prime Minister Gordon Brown in the Parliament celebrating President-elect Obama yesterday. As Obama prepares to take office, we here at The Takeaway are putting together a briefing book, talking to experts about a range of issues he will be confronting. We begin today by looking at the U.S. relationship with Europe and the United Kingdom. And for that, we spoke earlier to the BBC's Patrick O'Connell. Good morning, Patty.
Hey, good morning, Adora. Have you started voting for 2012 yet?
I think we're going to...
After lunch, that begins, lunch. Patrick. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
But listen, Patty, here you have the Prime Minister going out of his way to embrace Obama in the same way that he went out of his way to distance himself from President Bush. Why?
Well, everyone's trying to associate themselves with Barack Obama, even the Chinese. And they need lessons.
It's Barack Obama.
Barack Obama, yes, forgive me. And even the Chinese, and they need lessons in democracy. The one-party totalitarian state there, the Chinese president Hu Jintao, said he looked forward to strengthening dialogue. And our prime minister wants to say this shows that it's a serious man for serious times. And the leader of our opposition here, David Cameron from the Conservative Party, said, actually, it shows they've had enough of people who've been in power, pointing over to the Prime Minister, because the Labour Party's been in power for more than a year here.
And, well, let's listen to Cameron, since you brought him up.
In Britain, people are losing their homes, small businesses are closing, unemployment is rising, manufacturing output again today is falling, and by refusing to hold a public inquiry, the Prime Minister is yet again demonstrating that he cannot provide the change people want. On the day the American people voted for change, aren't people in this country entitled to ask, how much longer have we got to put up with more of the same from a government that's failed? Yeah!
So here you have the opposition party embracing this theme of change. So is it about Barack Obama that the folks in Britain are excited about, or is it this notion of change and how it might relate to their internal politics?
Well, let's take the first bit first. This is such an American story. You know, you'd have to be one of Europe's most stupid people if you didn't realize this is a chapter in American history. I can't believe it myself to be talking to you about such a chapter, you know. And I say that having listened to John McCain's speech, the humility of an American hero. I mean, we know as Europeans we're living as witnesses to a great moment of your history. What's going to happen to it, of course, no one knows. But, you know, this is extraordinary. The Europeans would be envious of your turnout rate, 75%, I believe.
That was huge. It was huge. Most in a century. I guess the question, aside from all the kind of American, you know, goosebumps that are generated around the world, what do you think the relationship between Gordon Brown and Barack Obama might possibly be based on Gordon Brown's relationship with W?
Yeah. Well, look, it's going to come down to what he does. this is a man with a mandate, but, you know, what is his mission? When will he pull troops out of Iraq? Under what circumstances? There are 165,000 US troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's going to happen to them? And what's going to happen to the British troops who fight alongside them? That's going to influence the relationship. What's going to happen to the $10 trillion debt? What's going to happen to Wall Street? What's going to happen to the US car manufacturing industry? Is he going to save it, or is it going to go to the wall? So the economy, the environment, and the wars, there are two wars, obviously, that's what's going to influence America's relationship with the world.
And how do you think, well, you're saying with the world, and is that different on the continent of Europe? Is the expectations of what Barack Obama is going to do, are they different in Britain than they are for the rest of Europe, or is Europe together in its expectation that Barack Obama's policies are going to be very different than George Bush's policies?
Well, I'd like to answer that by asking you and your American listener to turn that question round. What is the American expectation? And I think we could probably find, you know, 100 million expectations.
So it's kind of like, ask not what your Europe can do for you, ask what you can do for your Europe.
Well, I mean, I arrived in America as an intern, a congressional intern, and I knew a lot about America at 21. I knew its politics. I'd read all about it. And then I lived in America for 10 years, and I knew less about your country at the end of a decade at the age of 35. So, I mean, all I would say is that Barack Obama's got to reduce expectations. That's obviously the first thing.
Interesting.
And he's got to do it at home, and he's got to do it abroad. And I've been back, you know, I'm a great fan of your history, and I've been back to some, spent last night reading inauguration speeches.
Right.
And I read Dwight Eisenhower's from Tuesday, January the 20th, which is the same date, of course, January the 20th, that Barack Obama is going to be inaugurated. And this is 1953. "We must be ready to dare all for our country," said Dwight D. Eisenhower. "History does not long entrust the care of freedom to the weak or the timid." So I think this is a time to not just to talk about history, but to learn from it.
That's an interesting thought. Patrick O'Connell, thank you. Patrick O'Connell is a BBC correspondent based in London.
He's also a big host, a big, BBC. I mean, Patty's huge.
He's
monster huge. Anyway, we want you to be a part of the briefing book for the new President Barack Obama. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with suggestions about books to read, movies to see, music to listen to, or any other suggestion for this new president 75 days from inauguration.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And the world markets are not waiting for the Obama transition team to get in place. Joining us now is independent investment consultant Michael Hughes, former chief investment officer at Baring Asset Management. He joins us from Suffolk, England. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to get your reaction to a number of stories this morning. We've got jobless claims in the U.S. Jumping to the highest level in 25 years. It's the weekly jobless number, so it's not the overwhelmingly significant number, but still it's an important trend. But more importantly, there's a cascade of interest rate drops across England and the European continent, a 0.5% drop by the European Central Bank and a 0.5% drop by the Bank of England. What do you make of these interest rate cuts and their apparent recessionary woes that motivated them?
Well, it may be a hard thing to swallow, but we've taken out more debt in the UK as a proportion of our income than you have in the States. So we have a hell of a lot of debt that we're having to finance, and hence our interest rates really do matter. Now, the cut today has effectively taken interest rates down in line with the income growth. When you have debt which is bigger than income, you can't have interest rates that are higher than income growth. Otherwise, you have what the economists call a debt spiral. The whole thing gets blown out of proportion. So there has to be a dramatic cut here. And remember, even at 3%, we're still higher than the U.S. rates.
Much higher. Much higher. More than double the U.S. rate. I guess, is it difficult for Europe and the U.K. to get away from what seems to be a proclivity towards keeping interest rates high and supporting the currency as opposed to doing what you're saying?
No, for the UK, it's okay. They're doing it. They can do it. They have to do it. And arguably, interest rates here will have to come down to around 2% just to balance the book somewhat. In Europe, i.e. the Eurozone, it's different. They are lagging behind. Before today, it was always felt the UK was a bit slow on this. But today onwards, it's the Europeans that seem to be very slow. 0.5% has been taken as a disappointment in Europe, because they'd felt, given the news we'd seen elsewhere, that the rate cut might be greater than that. Well, it wasn't. They're still fairly conservative, and hence the downturn in Europe may end up being stronger and greater than it was in or is in the States.
It's always perilous to try to read the Dow and Wall Street CAT scan on any of this stuff, but it appears that there isn't much market sympathy for this rate cut move in Europe and the UK. Why would that be the case?
Well, partly because if you look at the history of our economies, when we are faced with this degree of financial calamity, it can last years. So even if you have a rate cut, you're not going to see the benefits of that for 1 and possibly even 2 years down the line.
So the market is really reacting to macro forces at this point, the idea of a prolonged recession, as opposed to following individual blips, investment grade sorts of blips in interest rate, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Okay. They don't believe that we're going to turn a corner quickly. And if we do, by and large, there may be some concerns about what happens to the currency further down the line. So it's a welcome cut, but it's not a very effective cut in terms of getting growth going again, because I think most people who have debt are going to be repaying it, and the interest rate reduction makes it easy for them to do that. But there's an awful lot of people, actually, right, both in the States and the UK, now retired, who actually depend on the interest from their bank account in order to live.
Right, and there's nothing about this that's going to unstiffen the wind of recession. Michael Hughes, formerly Chief Executive Investment Officer of Baring Asset Management. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 6th, and Femi Oke is here with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Large government banks across Europe are slashing interest rates at the moment, including the Bank of England and the European Central Bank. Despite the cuts, European markets have struggled this morning. Asian markets closed down sharply. Futures trading shows Wall Street investors betting on lower open in the American markets. Mexican government investigator says that there are no sign of foul play in a grisly plane crash that killed the country's interior minister. This follows a review of the jet's flight data recorder, and the minister was a key ally in the American-backed war on drug cartels. Barack Obama is out of the campaigning department and moving over to HR. He's got jobs to fill in his administration, and with little time and great challenges ahead. A team has quietly been vetting candidates even before the election, and one of the first big hires is expected to be Treasury Secretary, and Obama has also hinted at the possibility of keeping Bush Defense Secretary Robert Gates on the job. Hurricane season is not over yet, and we could have our next one as early as tomorrow. Tropical Storm Paloma is bulking up and could smash into Cuba as a hurricane. And finally, 106-year-old voter Ann Nixon Cooper got a special mention in Barack Obama's acceptance speech this week.
Well, I was waiting for it. I had heard that they would be calling my name at least.
And that is Ann Nixon Cooper, 106 years old. She was mentioned in the Obama speech, and she was actually given a tip-off a little bit earlier on the day by Obama's campaign office to tell her to stay up late to watch. And she says, "I never, never thought we would get a black president. Never." And that's a look at the news for now.
106 years old.
And she lives
wow.
in Atlanta.
She's seen it all. She's definitely seen it all now. Well, maybe she'll get to 107. She can help us with this transition. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE if you want to help brief the new president on what's going to happen over the next 75 days. And some people suspect, and it may be true, that one of the things that's going to be dealt with very early on in the Barack Obama administration is the relationship between the executive branch and Congress, a relationship that some say has seriously gotten out of whack in the 8 years of the Bush-Cheney administration. Here to talk about what some senators on Capitol Hill are thinking about that relationship and what's really changed in the last 8 years is Jonathan Mahler, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, friend of our show. John, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, for your article for the Sunday Times Magazine this Sunday, you interviewed some senators who expressed a lot of concern about how the separation of powers relationship has really changed between the White House and Congress. Describe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time with a handful of senators both on both sides of the aisle. The sort of central figures are Warner, Specter, Graham, Lindsey Graham, and Patrick Leahy. And yeah, there is a real concern there among a number of these guys that the Congress is no longer a kind of a co-equal partner in our government. And certainly, one of the defining features of the Bush administration was this sort of massive expansion of presidential power, and it came very much at the expense of a passive Congress. And that's certainly going to be a concern going forward as well.
And we're talking about issues like domestic surveillance.
The easiest way to look at it is in terms of the war on terror and the warrantless wiretapping program, the dozens of signing statements in which the president essentially said that he wasn't obligated to follow the letter of the law that he just signed into being,
and the use of the commander in chief phrase
exactly,
in Article 2
exactly.
to basically say I can do anything.
Exactly, the inherent quote-unquote inherent authority that he claimed he derived from.
And actually, Jonathan, I was really struck by that, where you quote Senator Lindsey Graham as saying that the Bush administration came up with a pretty aggressive, bordering on bizarre theory of inherent authority that had no boundaries. So why didn't they do something about it?
That's the logical next question. And that also, I think, in many ways goes to the problem, the larger problem with Congress, and I focused in particular on the Senate, and that is that, basically, nowadays, senators are far more loyal to their party than they are to the institution and, indeed, to their constituents. So you have this problem where Republican senators, when there's a Republican in the White House, as was the case for quite a while during the Bush administration, are reluctant to put any pressure on the president because they feel a certain kind of party loyalty to protect him, and that's not what Congress is supposed to do. Congress is supposed to check the president. Congress is supposed to prevent the president from overstepping his authority, and they're supposed to act aggressively to do that, that's where we are now.
Or as the case may be, the vice president. There's a great piece in the New York Review of books this in the latest issue about taking off from what Arlen Specter told you, the senator from Pennsylvania, that decades from now historians will look back at what happened over the last 8 years and go, what did happen here? And that was very much the impression of the power that the vice presidency has managed to acquire
during
the Bush administration. What did senators have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean that's right. I mean it's really quite staggering. I mean Cheney would basically go up every single week. He'd go up to Capitol Hill and caucus with the Republicans, and that's not supposed to happen. They're supposed to keep the executive branch out of their conversations.
I mean, the irony is that we've gotten so used to this notion of the vice president being in charge as kind of a shadow authority that when Sarah Palin says on the campaign trail he's the president of the Senate, most people go, yeah, well, that's right.
That's right. I think that's absolutely right. And of course, we all have to. Things are certainly going to be different going forward because in Obama we're going to have someone who's going to take a very different approach and attitude towards the president's obligation to uphold the nation's laws and the treaties,
so he's going to arrive in the White House. He's going to go, wow, look at these superpowers.
Exactly.
I'm going to get rid of these.
Exactly. That's the big but here, which is that you know, every president naturally wants to do everything he can to advance his agenda. And so so while he may do so, he may take a slightly different approach to it. I think, you know, we're always going to be looking at this same situation. And I think that's why we have a Congress, because the framers understood that every president was going to do this.
Well, and the Teddy Roosevelt history is important in as a lesson here, that he was very controversial for expanding powers under his administration, but it wasn't like Woodrow Wilson rolled them back.
That's right.
Would say in the Barack Obama case, this is a constitutional lawyer.
Right.
This is a legal scholar.
Yep. Yep.
How does that figure in here?
It certainly figures in, and presidential power was not a big issue during the campaign, unfortunately. But when Obama did speak to the issue, he did express a very different point of view from Bush. I mean, he once stated very explicitly in an interview with the Boston Globe that, you know, the president is not above the law. The president has to abide by the laws of the United States and the letter of the law of the Constitution. So that's all encouraging. On the other hand, you know, again, I think that it's a mistake to see this as a political question, to think, oh well, the Republicans are always going to try to, you know, they're going to have this idea of inherent authority and the unitary executive. They're going to try to amass as much power as possible, whereas the Democrats are going to take a very different attitude towards presidential power. That's not true. I mean, Clinton, for example, really attempted to do a great number of things that were sort of very muscular. Yeah.
And then, of course, FDR tried to pack the court years ago. Jonathan Mahler, as always, a fascinating discussion. Contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, Jonathan Mahler has a piece on this separation of power question as the transition for the Obama administration gets going.
And I think Jonathan is dead on. It should not be a political question. It shouldn't matter who's in power when we're taking a look at how the executive leg is run. Anyhow,
so you should brief Barack Obama on that.
I should brief him.
Join America.
I think there's
America's briefing book is getting assembled right here at the table.
It is, and we're asking what should be in it. What do you think Barack Obama needs to know before he takes office?
Hi, this is Jim Royce from Springfield, Massachusetts. And in President Obama's briefing book, among the first things should be to publicly and very transparently repudiate the consolidation of presidential powers President Bush has taken.
Exactly what Jonathan Mahler was talking about. Sylvia, well, she also has a suggestion.
The book I'd like to recommend for Obama to read is The Gospel of Life by John Paul II, where he stresses the importance of a government that protects human rights, especially the fundamental, the first one, the right to life.
What do you think Barack Obama should be spending his very limited time as he prepares to take over the White House? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
75 more days only in this transition, and we want you to be a part of the briefing. Here's your takeaway.
Barack Obama's got to reduce expectations. That's obviously the first thing. He's got to do it at home, and he's got to do it abroad.
That's BBC host Patrick O'Connell talking with us from London. He's also part of the briefing. What's the European relationship and UK relationship with Barack Obama going to be like?
So fascinating. Reduce expectations. How do you think he could do that? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
They couldn't get any higher, that's for sure.
I know. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.